Hello and welcome to Ready Free Nintendo episode 442. I am your host, James Jones. I don't have any adjectives this week because that's actually really hard to do and I got tired of doing it after two times.
Really? I thought you would at least get to B.
But... Well, no, because I was going to do A, B, A, C, A, D, A, E, A, F and then realize this was going to end poorly. So that was Guillaume who's just, I can't see Guillaume coming up with four adjectives every week. People may not know. So get on your SAT words, Guillaume.
I'm the bootylicious Guillaume.
I don't have enough information to argue with him either.
You keep that up, and that might turn into the episode title. Also, this week we have John.
I don't have a last name, apparently.
Lindemann.
All right, thank you.
It's less necessary now. There's no more John Johnny nonsense.
You know, that's right. Always... I don't have to be super clear anymore.
That's why John spoke so little, so they wouldn't get confused.
Would you like to use an alias?
I'll think about it.
Right. Where are we going?
We're starting a podcast with our final introduction. It's Greg Leahy.
Hoi hoi, everyone.
Hello, Greg. I'm sorry you had to suffer through the other two introductions.
I signed up for it, didn't I?
We're all here for this together. And we're also here together for new business. And I'm going to start up this week because, you know, I spent most of the summer chastising Nintendo for the summer of too hot for games. And then they went and gave us game. Singular, but game. They have published the level 5... game Little Battler Experience on 3DS, which is, you know, part of a, as we call them, the transmedia property. The video game, anime, toys, movies, music, etc., etc., everything possible that we get out of these level 5 games from Japan.
I believe Square called it polymorphic content.
That sounds like something they would say, yes.
Back when it was FF13 was supposed to be in its many forms.
That sounds like a thing that they would have named something. So this series actually started on the PlayStation Portable, and then it sort of made its way over to the 3DS. This is actually the first 3DS game that there were three, I think. So this game came out originally in 2009 or 2010, I think. So it's been a little while since this game came out. So
wow,
yeah. This is not the hottest newest takes coming out of Japan.
Oh god. so it's kind of an Inazuma 11 situation where we're obviously also a level 5 polymorphic content thing.
Yes,
where
that's what they do.
We're sort of jumping into it, but. Having to go back in time to do it, kind of thing.
Right. And so it shares a lot with that series. It's just this is the one that they sort of started on, you know, in the next generation of handhelds afterwards, because that was originally a DS series of games.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it started on the PSP, so it started kind of the same time. But, you know, they launched this franchise with pretty much every avenue of money making they could possibly do, which is kind of level 5's thing. So I'll talk a little about this game, and I'm going to describe it combining two games that someone in our audience is going to get super excited when they hear me use these phrases together. Mega Man Battle Network Gacha Force. That's what this game is. So essentially that's probably not helpful for 99% of the people listening to the show.
And that's a good thing.
But Dr. Jonathan Metz is super excited right now. What that means is the game takes place is, you know, kind of, I mean, it feels like you're watching a children's anime, which guess what? It is. And in fact, I think it may actually follow the plot of the TV show, you know, on the beats, as it were. So including using video from it. So it's set up in episodes where you're very, very driven, like, okay, go here, now go here, now go here, now go here. It's so if you play the Inazuma 11 games, it's a lot like that. I mean, there's definitely kind of a connected lineage there. You feel this sense of like, okay, now go to the LBX store and get this. Now go back to school because it's time for class. Now go out to the riverfront and go talk to what's his name. And you just keep getting these directives to go do this stuff. And then an episode will end and then another episode will start and you'll get the opening music because it thinks it's an anime with like the opening video and everything. It's in there. So what this game is about, it's about kids battling to save the world. I know that doesn't describe a whole lot. because that's pretty much every game like this, but as opposed to playing soccer, they're battling with little robots that you can customize, and that's where the Gacha Force comes in, or Chibi Robo. Sorry, not Chibi Robo. Damn it. What is
Custom
it?
Robo.
Custom Robo. Yeah, which is quite literally, I mean, one of the most literally named games ever. But this is essentially, you know, it's Gacha Force, this game. And there's a reason you see a lot of these games come out of Japan, because, you know, it ties in very cleanly to the love of making models in Japan and Japan's love of robots and kids battling stuff. It all kind of meshes in nicely. So you get a robot. You buy parts for it, you upgrade it by changing its parts, different parts form different ways, they give you access to different skills, and then you battle in these arenas that are, from a person scale, the size of a cardboard box. They're called super strong cardboards. They hold in the attacks because kids were getting hurt. That sounds like a Japan thing if I've ever heard it. But in the actual combat, it's third person action game in kind of a large area, with obstacles like buildings or cliffs. You know, there's different settings. Some of them are in the city, some of them are in like a canyon, you know, stuff like that. So there's lots of obstacles to maneuver around and to hide behind. Basically, it's, you can jump, you can dash, and then you can attack. And depending on what kind of weapon you have, determines if you have a, you know, ranged attack, close range attack, you know, dual wielding, shields, guns, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not very far into the game, which is why I'm giving all this background information, because I don't have a lot of play experience to talk about just yet. About 3 hours in, and about an hour and a half of that was them just handing me story. So basically, you go around town, you go from story point to story point, or you can challenge people who are just hanging out to battles. Combat's pretty quick. It feels fairly responsive, although there's already kind of a sameness to it. The robot that they give you, you know, the literal Deus Ex Machina robot that your hero character has, is very... Before you start customizing, it has a very clear strategy of jump, attack, jump, attack, jump, attack, that will get you through 95% of the battles, including the boss fights. You know, you can, as you power up your gauge, you get access to special attacks. You know, it's not revolutionary. Like I said, I rattled off two GameCube games of all systems that very clearly can be mapped from a gameplay standpoint to this game. So it's really a matter of, you know, how does it feel? It feels fine. How is the customization? I don't know yet, because I really just got access to start buying parts, and the shop doesn't have a lot of stuff in it. And like I said, I've got the Deus Ex Machina bot, so to a certain extent, everything in the shop's not very useful to me right now. Your parts level up, which is weird. So you level up, and your parts level up, and then, so there's this, do I want to change out parts for this higher level part, or just want to grind this part up and get it stronger? You know, it's, There is definitely going to be some strategy here in building your little battler, as they're referred to, your LBX. I don't know what the X stands for. I guess the noun is also the experience, which is also the name for the robot. I don't know. It's Japan. But from a combat standpoint, there's definitely already been some strategy I've had to deal with. So before we started recording, I was fighting this girl. She had what they call a strider frame. So there's like the core of the robot, the frame, and there's the parts you put on it. And a strider frame is really fast, and the armor she was using is also about being really fast. So she is very agile. She can jump. She can use her boost. She, even when she's not boosting, she can cover a lot of ground very quickly, or she can get away from you very quickly, as the problem was here. And her weapon was this high powered rifle that fires pretty quick. I mean, it's the shots individually are slow, but the speed that they cover, usually you can dodge most gunfire, but hers are quick, so they're harder to dodge, and she has a really long range. So the entire battle was, I need to get super close to her. And the different types of combat, because there's a couple different types of, you know, arena style and combat style. In her case, it was first to fall 3 times. So I had to get close to her and then get away when she got back up, because she's got invincibility frames, and then get back in close. But that meant I had to put gaps between her and myself, which meant she could shoot me. So I actually lost that the first time I played it. And then the second time I just stuck to her like glue and kept jump attacking. And that was enough to pull out a victory. But I mean, I really had to lame it out. Like it was not, nobody was going to, you know, award me for a great show of skill on that particular
combat. No star points.
No. it was the equivalent of the duck kick in the first Mortal Kombat game. Like that was I was laming it out in an extreme fashion, because I wasn't even knocking her down with it. Like I was just depleting her health so she would fall down. versus using the combo attacks, which do knock them down, but then they get up with invincibility frames. I didn't feel like I could risk her having invincibility frames. But on the opposite, there was a boss whose entire, you know, skill set is around super up close hard hits. And although your LBX at that moment is equipped for that, this is a boss character. So you're obviously, you know, you're supposed to do your ascendancy here of overpowering the stronger opponent because hero in Japanese anime. So again, I lamed it out by using my really weak gun and just running from him constantly. And most of the battles take like 50 seconds, a minute. This one, I stretched it on out to like 4, just because I was like, I can't get close to him, he's gonna kill me. You gain party members, so they're your friends. Again, this has some Mega Man Battle Network here. They're your middle school friends who have all the personalities of middle school friends in a game like this. And they have their own robots that you have some customization over that have different skill sets, and you can swap who's in the party. And, you know, sometimes the battle is a 3-on-3, sometimes it's a 2-on-2. Sometimes it's a first to fall or first to three falls, or sometimes it's just, they call them, what do they call it? They call it like, no restraints, which is basically all the stats are tuned up for the fight. So you hit harder and there's more health, but essentially the loser's robot is destroyed. Which for you would be a problem. And so far they've only been story mode fights, no rando battles here, or none of the walk up to somebody and challenge them. And I'm guessing that's probably the case, because if your robot was destroyed, the game's plot would end. So, you know, I'm enjoying it well enough. Like I said, I haven't gotten super deep into it. You know, the world is very tightly controlled. Essentially, it's a series of hallways that are connected by an overland map, you know, very Inazuma 11 in that case, or Mega Man Battle Network. The combat, it's not super deep yet, but I assume the customization will allow it to gain depth. You know, equipping, deciding what super attacks to equip for a given battle, what weapons make sense against a certain opponent, how best to mitigate their skill set by combat strategy. But at the moment, it's been a lot of jump attacks, so we're getting there. But, you know, it's fun enough so far. I'm not thinking I'm going to be able to play it for long sessions. There is something undeniably charming about Inazuma 11 that's missing here a little bit. I think it's something about the fact that kids were shooting dragons out of their feet and then just straight up beaming other children in the head and sending them flying. Like, there's something deeply satisfying about that.
You're telling me they managed to make football more absurd than people battling crazy little robots in cardboard boxes.
armored cardboard boxes, and yes, they did. but there's definitely something there that is slowly kind of starting to work. You know, it's not going to be, I can already tell you the plot's not going to be, you know, a tour de force here, but if you, to give you some context, if you didn't play like a Mega Man Battle Network or Inazuma 11, think a Pokemon story with your cartoon evil organization that's like, we hate fire, so we're going to blow up the sun. And you're like, what kind of plan do you have? So far, I'm in the middle of a mission where they are going to use these robots to assassinate the Prime Minister. What? So that's these children have been tasked with stopping the assassination of the Prime Minister.
Because they follow politics very closely and definitely have a stake in it.
Yeah, well, what's amusing to me personally is that it's the assassination is going to take place during the inaugural parade of the Prime Minister, which, I mean, I live in a country that has a strong executive system, but I don't recall Prime Ministers usually having inaugural parades. That seems somewhat unusual for an executive that's not directly elected. But regardless, so I guess after the show, I'm going to save an elected official from being killed by small toy robots.
I was reliably informed by Liberation Maiden that the Prime Minister was in a giant robot.
No, she's the president.
She was the president. That's true. Yeah.
She was the president of Japan. And
you have to be the president of Japan together.
And she inherited the title from her father. Yes. Which is not how presidencies work unless you're in North Korea. So, I'm giving this game an honest shot because it's out, essentially. You know, normally I probably would have passed on it. But, you know, people have told me that there is definitely something here, and I'm kind of seeing hints of it. So, I will definitely have an update next week where I'm hoping to, you know, have at least 15 or so hours in, and I can give, you know, a more nuanced approach to what the systems look like. Because as it stands now, they're still introducing me to new components of gameplay. So obviously there's some depth here that they're going to get into. And hopefully I can't just spam out jump, attack, jump attack for the rest of the game. I mean, or hopefully I can, so I get through this thing quickly. One or the other. We'll see. So, up next, we'll have Greg, who's got some, who's now seeing in more than 2Ds.
Well, the 3D classics, Gunstar Heroes came out last week. Tease this one. Although, before I get on to that, I do want to mention the previous one, which is Streets of Rage 2, very briefly. I'd not played a Streets of Rage game before. By the way.
Oh, really?
But yeah, because I didn't have a Mega Drive or Genesis growing up, and you know, it was just that Final Fight knockoff to me, basically. You know, I never really thought it was, you know, anything that amazing, and didn't get around to it on Virtual Console when I had the Japanese Wii. But you know, getting around to it now, because yeah, you know, people seem to think it's one of the best sort of exponents of that kind of game, and I am, you know, amenable to it in small doses. You know, I'm not a huge fan of that kind of brawler type of game, but, you know, I enjoyed Final Fight a little bit, and obviously they're better in co-op, and even though you have that capacity, with the 3D classics in terms of, like, you know, if you've got a friend that has a copy of the game or whatever, you could do the wireless multiplayer, but that's not going to happen for me. So it's strictly a one-player proposition, but I think the funniest thing about it is, for a game that in my mind existed as just that Final Fight knockoff, it is astonishing that when I played it, I was aghast at how much it ripped off Final Fight.
Yeah.
I just, you know what I mean? Like, I was expecting it to be a ripoff,
oh, yeah,
but not that much of a ripoff. Like, individual enemies are, you know, the scenarios, some of them are precisely so. Oh, here's where you're in the underground fighting arena, and you know, like it was,
yep,
remarkable. Like, the fat enemies and the you know, the kind of little punk enemies, and everything's just like, oh my god, how was there not legal action? This is the second one. Like, I, yeah, you know, it was shocking. I may have just naive, but I wasn't expecting.
Yeah, for some reason, stuff is always hidden in barrels, and it's always, yeah, like chicken or apples, and mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it is so it's just absolutely every beat of Final Fight is kind of replicated with this. But you know, one thing I do like about it thematically is the fact that it does go more silly. The fact that you, because it is an intrinsically silly genre, so the fact, right, that, you know, for instance, you get to the middle of a baseball field and then home plate turns into an elevator that takes you to some sort of underground base. the fact that you go into a fairground and then there's like a part of it that's like a hive from aliens or something, like, it's just,
wow,
the randomness of it is definitely a plus. And the fact that, you know, I think there's a little bit more sort of nuance in the gameplay with, you know, sort of different techniques you can do. And, mm-hmm, and one thing I do like is the Rage Relay mode that they put in, M2 put in for this release, which makes you sort of trade off between the different characters. So just kind of that adds a bit of variety into your gameplay.
Right. I think that they explained in an interview that when people chose a character at the beginning of the game, usually they didn't switch. So they only experienced that one, character, and it became monotonous, right? So they,
yeah,
wanted to,
I mean,
force
it's
people.
It's the kind of game that's always going to have a problem with that. Mm-hmm. So anything that could kind of relieve the monotony, sort of forcing people to switch, I think is a decent idea to sign up for, because, mm-hmm, you know, with that kind of game, you could kind of fall into this, like, I've got something that works, you know, like, just to make sure that everybody gets on one side of the screen, and then I'll just kind of fend them off and all that kind of, you know. So I think it's a good idea to at least have different characters to make you achieve that a different way. So, I mean, it's obviously a beautifully presented version of the game, and you get the very, very well thought of soundtrack and all that kind of stuff. So I was pleased with it, despite being sort of slightly shocked by how brazen it is. But
I was going to say that, you know, Capcom was getting it from all sides at that point, because SNK was just ripping them off wholesale as much, yeah, as they could, well, possibly get away with.
That's because their games were so popular in the arcade. I mean, Final, yeah, Fight was huge in the arcade.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, everybody had to compete with that. Or wanted, yep, a piece of the pie, really.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, Super Nintendo Final Fight's not that great, but it had a version of it, which at the time of the Genesis did not. Later on, there would be a Mega CD or Sega CD version that's like one of the best home versions of the era, but I guess they felt like they needed to at the time, and then a lot of people like Streets of Rage better, in retrospect. So it's technically proficient with all the stuff going on for the Mega Drive. It's quite impressive in that regard. But with something that definitely one-ups Streets of Rage 2 in that capacity is Gunstar Heroes, which has a ton of stuff going on screen at the same time. Certainly, it's got plenty of sort of graphical verve in it that will remind you of Super Nintendo games in terms of, some rotation stuff, some faux 3D stuff. But at the same time, there's so much more going on that the Super Nintendo's weedy processor could ever have handled at once without it sort of chugging to a crawl, probably. This is one of the, one of the reasons why Treasure, did what they did in having been at Konami and making a lot of Super Nintendo stuff, ended up making their home on the Mega Drive, where, in Japan, it was pretty much irrelevant, during that generation. But nonetheless, they went there, and Gunstar Heroes in 3D is a wonderful thing. It's, I find it actually more playable because all the crazy stuff that's going on, the multiple, background layers, all the sprites, all that kind of stuff, it's easier to discern for me, as I'm quite happy with the 3D effect. It doesn't give me any issues. It just kind of helps me tell everything apart a little bit better in terms of, what is relevant and what isn't. The visual information is kind of filtered a little bit for me, so I find it a little bit easier to play in that regard.
Yeah, I was kind of skeptical. I wasn't sure how it would go over because certain genres obviously take to 3D better than others. And, the last thing you want in a 2D platformer is just kind of always feeling like you're sort of, I don't know. It's like
out of space. You feel disconnected from the world, as it were.
Yeah, kind of feeling like your view is actually obscured instead of just being a part of the environment.
Yes.
No, I know what you mean, but it's very uncommon for a Mega Drive game to have this many background layers, and some of them are go by super fatigue of the Seven Force battle, where you kind of going through the mine shaft at high speed. Yeah, that's scrolling by really quick, and it's just I found that more distracting when I was playing it on the Wii Virtual Console, because now it's you can sort of focus on the foreground and kind of leave that more out of it.
Yeah, and they also have a lot of enemies coming in from the foreground and background as well.
Yeah,
which makes it easier to track.
It almost seems like it was designed with 3D in mind, some of the stuff, enemies shooting off into distance, Team Rocket style and all this kind of
stuff.
Nice. Yep. And I mean, one thing that I've said, well, I said long ago, back when, the 3DS was new, one thing I really like about what Stereoscopic 3D can do for side-scrolling games is give them a sense of scale that they otherwise don't have. Mm-hmm. Because you can have a background layer, but it's like, well, if you're just looking at pixel art, without any kind of stereoscopic effect, it's like, okay, I can see this stuff in the background layer, this parallax or whatever, to give you some idea, but it's like, how far away is that, or how big is that object that's in the distance? Whereas, would you bring the 3D into play? Like, for instance, when you're in one of the later stages of Gunstar, you're fighting in a space battle. The background seems really far away. So it gives you this sense of scale that you actually, going up against this giant spaceship that, you didn't have that sense of scale in the other levels. So I always like that, just to give it, because it is difficult with side-scrolling games where it's just, a few layers moving across each other at different rates to really imply that the same way that you can engage with 3D perspectives. But, I think the biggest thing that I've got out of it so far in terms of replaying the game, it's been about 6 years, I think, since I played it on Wii, the first time I played it all the way through, is the new Gunslinger mode, similar to sort of Rage Relay. M2, and they've done this with quite a few of them as well. I think Shinobi 3 had a new mode that kind of separated out some control functions, something like expert ninja mode. I can't remember exactly what it was called, but basically it was kind of looking at the fact that the 3DS has more buttons than the standard Mega Drive controller did, and so they could separate out some of the functions. And you've got a similar sort of thing here, because what you could do in Gunslinger mode now is, first of all, you could switch between sort of having your character be fixed when you're shooting and being able to run and gun. In the past, that was a character choice. Here, mm-hmm. you could just switch the characters on the fly in the gunslinger mode with a press of the X button. And then the other part of it is that you could switch guns with your gun weapon type. The famous thing about Guns and Warriors is that there's four different types of weapon, and you can sort of mix and match them to create different effects when you hold two at a time. And in this, you could use the L button to switch weapon type 1 and the R button to switch weapon type 2. So naturally, this does make the game a fair bit easier, because you can, you know, strategically select whichever weapon you think is the best for a given situation. So what I did is went into the sort of standard options within the game, bumped the difficulty up to kind of balance it out, and it's been really fun. It's a great way to experience the game anew. You know, I've had certain parts of the game kind of have shone through a little more than I remember them doing 6 years ago. Like the shoot 'em up part, I really liked quite a lot more, with the ability to change up my tactics on the fly rather than being beholden to when certain power-ups come along, which, you know, I mean, I don't know whether I'd say this is the way to play it the first time round, because the game was clearly designed around where those rapid drops were and all that kind of thing. But for replayability, or to go up on a higher difficulty or something like that, I think it's really cool, because it doesn't break the game, and it kind of shows off the fun of the weapon combinations in a new way.
Now, what are you playing it on? Are you playing it on the new 3DS XL?
I'm playing it on the 3DS XL.
Okay.
Where I've got all my 3D classics on that one.
Yeah, because I'm playing it on the old school original 3DS, and it's a little bit... I'm really wishing that I had an XL to play it.
Yeah, there's a lot... It is busy, as we
yeah,
said, so
it's
I can
busy
imagine that.
And
little
it's,
bullets it's, coming around. And
yeah, you know, yeah. Yeah, I wish the screen was bigger, and just... I mean, just because... the game looks great, so I wish I was playing it on a larger screen. And also, it's the kind of game where you want to keep shooting, so you're always holding down the shoot button while you're jumping. So, and it's kind of, I don't know, the original 3DS is a little bit small, so it's kind of cramped for games mm-hmm. like that on the right-hand side, you know? So, yeah, it's not optimal. I'd prefer to play it on an XL for sure. So.
Yeah. I mean, obviously this kind of game, the optimal experience is, you know, you'd like to play with a gamepad, you know, with a Super Nintendo controller. So that's how I played it on the Wii. But, you know, XL's, you're pretty good. You know, they're a little bit more spacious, and, definitely being able to take in all that detail, all the frenetic quality of the game on a bigger screen, it certainly helps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, definitely. I mean, if you like something like Contra 3 and you haven't played this, you need to play this.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it strips out. I mean, it has variety, but it's not like Contra where you get like the superfluous overhead levels or something like that. You know, I mean, it's a bit more all out, you know, non-stop than Contra 3 that way, a bit beefier. And also important to mention, the way the health works is more forgiving, because, you know, you've got a sliding health meter. It's not like you've got 3 lives and you die in one hit, and once you run out of lives, that's that. You know, I mean, and also they put in like a mega life mode or whatever, separate from the gunslinger thing, so you could just like double your health on top of you. So, you know, I mean, I think that it liberates the design a bit from where they were with Contra 3, because mm-hmm. now it's like, okay, we could design things to be crazy and overwhelming, because, you know, you're not going to die in one hit. We don't have to worry about like trying to be fair based on that limitation anymore. And I think it the game is a lot more fun and inviting for it, and has kind of some brawler-esque qualities almost, you know, because of that. And you can throw enemies, slide and kick and all this, more physical too. Mm-hmm. I imagine it would be an absolute riot in co-op, but like I said, that's never going to happen for me, sadly.
Yeah, I just love the fact that all the health in the game is displayed numerically. There's no guesswork involved. There's like, yep, this boss has 1,800 health. Go ahead, and you just watch the health number go down.
Just whale.
Yep.
In a way, there's a certain elegance to that design conceit.
Yeah, I like it a lot.
Pips.
Yeah, yeah. Or just like, or like health bars where you're never really quite sure how much is left.
Right.
You know?
It's very obvious, like, you know, which weapon types are kind of doing the best, you know, the damage the most effectively, you know, when you can yep. see the numbers going down. And that's the thing. I mean, certainly on the harder difficulties, like the one thing that's tempted to do when you've got complete mastery over the weapon types is to sort of cheese the homing ones. But on the harder difficulty, the homing ones get nerfed a bit. So like I said, it does balance out a little bit quite nicely.
Hmm. Cool.
Yeah. It's good stuff.
Yeah.
It'd be great. Love it.
Cool.
It's all about Treasure at the moment. Sin and Punishment both coming out in America.
Yeah.
Both games.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to check those out. Does anybody know if you get the discount? I'm assuming you do if you've bought it on Wii.
For the Wii one. Yeah. Although there's an import premium on it. It's $12 instead of $10.
Well, there was originally too.
But they're replicating that is the point.
Yeah.
I wonder whether they might kind of lay off that now that the novelty of it coming to the West for the first time has long since worn off.
Nope.
I'm a little surprised they dumped them both the same day. That was
Weird. Well, because we had Sin and Punishment 2
right.
several months ago. So it was a long time ago, but we've not got the N64 one yet, which I will get off TV play Sin and Punishment.
Yeah, that's
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I can confirm that at least they didn't double the import tax. If you upgrade from the Wii version, if you did the transfer, then you're paying $2 like everyone else for every other game.
N64 game, yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
That's good. That makes me happy.
Yep.
So, Guillaume?
Yeah. I've been playing Woe Dave on the Wii U. It came out last week and maybe some people don't know this, but if you bought the game on the 3DS, you already have the Wii U version. So
I did not know that.
Yeah, just hop on your Wii U, go to the eShop, and you'll see the icon to buy it will instead say download for free. So
the unified account future is here.
Yeah, and a lot of people I think got it for like 99 cents back when there was some crazy sale. So it's an excellent deal, and it's not the 3DS version; it's the the deluxe version that came out on Steam kind of recently. So this adds a two-player competitive mode. I mean, you're cooperating because you're clearing the screen together, but you're stealing each other's sense. So you're competing.
A four swords kind of thing.
Yep. Except in this case, it's really two players max. Maybe it would just get too crazy with four people.
Sure.
But yeah, so this is probably the biggest addition. But you also get two new stages, which do add a couple of interesting wrinkles. The second stage on top of the screen, there's these warps, and the enemies and yourself can go through them, and you wrap around the screen. So it does make for more chaos. There are enemies that come at you that you don't necessarily see coming anymore. So, and same thing with the third level. You've got these kind of platforms that go up and down. And what that does is sometimes enemies that have been traveling along and to the bottom of the screen, like they usually do, get taken back up to you know, threaten you again. So, again, like it's much more challenging than the default stage or the original stage. So it's pretty good. I mean, if some people haven't played Woe Dave, yet, it's an excellent arcadey style game. It's kind of this cross between, I don't know, Joust and Mario Brothers.
Absolutely. Yes. That's it. Exactly.
Yeah. So, you just have enemies. Well, actually, you have eggs falling from the top of the screen. Eggs and skulls. The skulls explode after a while, and they're kind of your weapon. And eggs, you can touch and grab and throw like the skulls, and you can also use them as weapons. But eventually, they hatch. Enemies come out. These enemies will just, you know, follow a very simple path to the bottom of the screen where they're going to fall in lava, jump out on fire from below you because you're standing on a platform above that. And so you got to watch out for that. And also, every time that they fall in the lava, they come out upgraded, a slightly stronger or more faster enemy. So you kind of wonder, well, why would I let them do that? Why would I not kill them before they get to the bottom? And the thing is, this is a high score game, and the more the higher level the enemies that you kill, the more coins you get. So if you're aiming for a high score and you don't want it to take forever, you definitely want them to upgrade. So yeah, I don't know. Like it's a really crazy game, kind of Atari looking graphics and very old school. And I don't know, like maybe look at a video, see if it's something that you'd be into. But it's got very good reviews in general. And when we got in on 3DS, I think who talked about it? Was it Johnny? You did?
Well, Johnny did, and I did, but separately.
Right. But you liked it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was playing in a single player environment, and it was kind of like, okay, this is Mario Brothers.
Right. Except better than that. I've played actually.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not something, you know, sitting there on your own, you're probably going to play for a long period of time.
Right. Except that once you start, and if you're always on the verge of beating your high score, you might end up going to bed a little bit later than you intended.
Yes. And that would, for me, that's just not the appeal usually. So that's the difference there.
Right. So yeah, that's Whoa Dave, and you may already have it, so check it out. another game that I've been playing, and I don't even know, do I even want to tackle this? I've been playing...
Give it a high level.
Ah, my God. I'm playing Final Fantasy VII, and yes, I'm playing it for kind of the first time.
I still haven't touched it ever.
Right.
I'm interested to avoid it for
this long, huh?
I'm interested to hear, you know, what it's like for someone tackling it now.
How are you playing it?
I'm playing it on the PSP Go, so I have it portable.
the few, the proud.
Oh, that's... I'd forgotten what that was briefly.
Yeah, you're having a PSP Go, I must say. That's one of the weirdest things that...
No, I think I've explained it on the show before. I got the Go because it was cheaper to get that instead of the memory plus a regular PSP. So I got it on sale, and I don't regret it because I never really intended to buy UMDs. So I don't know. It worked out for me.
I bought a PSP without Wi-Fi that had a busted UMD drive.
Oh wow!
Off eBay. That's how I tackled that site.
This is dark, John. I mean, I feel like you need to get these and just drop them in a bathtub, and we'll just call it a day.
That would complete the cycle of death. Yes.
Anyway, so Final Fantasy, I did try to play when it came out on the PSN for the first time. I couldn't find the game really before then because it was always kind of an expensive game. For a long time, like Square had reissued 8 and 9 and the compilations of NES games, but they had not re-released 7, I guess, because Sony had parts of the rights. So really, like, PSN was the first time that I found it affordably. So I started that, and then I stopped playing after about 15 hours. Now I'm about 15 hours in, and I'm thinking about dropping it again. Because it's just, I don't know, it's not really clicking for me. And I thought that I had been properly warned, you know? Like, this game is so revered by so many people. It's considered one of the best games of all time by some. And other people are like, well, no, Final Fantasy VI was so much better. But I was already, like, I already saw all that criticism. Like, I already was well aware through, I don't know, listening to Retronauts or whatever, that the translation was not very good.
Nope.
That the story maybe didn't quite make sense unless you read up on it and stuff like that. But I'm still kind of shocked at how detached from the whole thing I am. I'm not getting into these characters at all. And it's just the poor translation. I would have thought, I'm used to poor translations. Again, like, I started with Final Fantasy Legend 2. Look up that dialogue.
That game's barely translated.
It's barely translated. It doesn't make any sense. And so I thought I would be able to get over that hurdle. But turns out, like, these characters, sometimes you have conversations and it just seems like a series of non sequiturs. You know, it feels like two people not even talking about the same thing, not even talking to each other, just saying random
crap. Talking across each other.
Yeah, well, basically.
So let me just ask, without going into too much, I mean, spoiler territory, I guess, but how, like, where are you in this game? Like, do you have a full party? Are you out of the city? Stuff like that.
Yeah, I'm out of the city, which takes forever, by the way.
Yeah, that's what I was asking.
Yeah. No, Midgar is not my favorite place. It feels like in Final Fantasy VI, like if you were stuck in Narsh for, I don't know, like 10 hours, it doesn't have the, anyway. So yeah, I'm out of the city. I'm actually on my way to the Temple of the Ancients. I need some key thing first. So I think that's some material. I had to look it up. I'm kind of stuck right now.
Okay. I would say go through the Temple of the Ancients.
Right. I'm guessing there's a big plot point, which I already know about.
Yeah.
That's probably there. But,
and you do already know about it. Yes. And that,
we can probably talk about it, right?
I don't know if it's, I mean, almost as the meme, I would rather we didn't. just because it's funnier because everybody knows what we're talking about and we just don't want to say it.
Right. Well, it kind of ties into the whole dialogue is bad thing because these characters, I can't get into them. And I thought, okay, I'm going to have this character in my party because I want to develop a bond with the character. I want to be, you know, moved when whatever happens.
Great.
Anyway, it's hard to dance around the topic, but
AstroTurf grief.
No, but you know, like I was like, well, might as well, like instead of going the route of, well, I'm not going to use this character because I'm not going to have it in a while. I was like, well, might as well get the experience.
Because she goes on vacation.
Right.
Permanent vacation.
She takes a nap.
Yeah. She ran away. Anyway, the thing is, like, every character is more bland than the next. Cloud is not a very strong character so far. I think that having a main character with amnesia is really a big faux pas, you know, because he doesn't know half the stuff that's going on. He doesn't feel like he's much of a leader at all at any time. Most of the time, decisions are made for him or, like, stuff happens and he just goes along. And it's the same thing with, like, Tifa. She hasn't really proven to be all that interesting yet. And Aerith.
She's probably the only character that gets at least somewhat redeemed this whole this whole freaking disaster of a game. Yeah,
I feel like a lot of the stuff in here is so tropey that now that it's been done to death, it's hard to go back and experience it again.
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, that's not their fault. Like they were there first, not first, but they were there much earlier than a lot of
it
stuff.
Was a lot fresher back then than it is now.
Yeah, but I don't know. Like, I've gone back and played games like Phantasy Star 4, and they've got much better writing and plot points that are similar, very anime, very tropey, but much more effective and making you care for the characters and care for what's happening to them.
The one thing that I would point out, and not as a great excuse, but part of the reason why, you know, maybe the plot isn't written as well as it probably could be, is that Phantasy Star 4 was attempting about 1/30th the ambition of Final Fantasy 7. Like, if anything, this game is ambitious to a fault.
Chocobo racing. That's what it's all about.
No, Chocobo breeding. The racing is secondary.
So to complete that thought, like what's funny is that some of the characters that are the worst written, like Barret and Cid, actually have the most personality. Like, it's this weird thing where Cid will call the Empire, like, he'll say, that's why they're so anal. Or, I don't know, he'll say thing like, oh, there ain't gonna be shit left when we blast off, and this is gonna be a big splash, hold on to your drawers and piss, and don't piss in them. And it's like, wow, this is, like, some of the worst...
best writing?
The trying hardest dialogue that I've ever seen, like, trying so hard to be edgy and to impress teenagers, I guess. And
trying to impress teenagers with characters who are apparently a tribute to a member of Pink Floyd. That's interesting balance.
There you go.
You know, like,
I wish they were here.
He's such a bad character.
You wish
and
Pink
yet,
Floyd was here? Or Sid?
Sid Barrett.
Oh, God.
Anyway, so, like, these characters are so over the top, but... yet, like, they're the only characters that I care about so far because they're the only ones who aren't bland as, you know, like a glass of milk.
All right. Fair enough. Well, if you decide to go back to it or you decide to keep at it, you know, give us an update. Tell us how you're feeling.
I really hope that they lay off with the freaking mini games because it seems like...
It doesn't.
Oh,
well,
my God.
They become more optional. Once you get past the RTS mini game, which there's an RTS mini game in here.
Yep. Yeah, I tried it. It was all right. I'm thinking more of, I've been playing Simon Says, I feel, for like 5 hours.
There's quite a bit. I mean, but keep in mind, this is pre, you know,
Quick time events.
Yeah. So the Simon Says is sort of the analog for what quick time events would become. In the remake, those will be quick time events.
just do away with them. But anyway, I'll keep playing. Like, I started this, like, believe it or not, with an open mind. Like, I thought I knew what I was getting into, and I want to like it. I wanted to get into an RPG, and people maybe who love this game who are listening to me are like, wow, Guillaume just wanted to bash on this game. But
Somebody's going to come down on Heresy, but if this one doesn't do it for you, give 9 a consideration.
Oh, I've played 9, actually. Oh,
okay. All right.
That one was harder, easier to get, actually. So I played that years ago. It was okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah, fair enough. John.
Well, James, you know
why
that
you, why don't you go long and give us your
business. I hate talking about Nintendo stuff. It's just not my style.
Well, I'm here to catch what you're throwing, so give it to me.
All right.
Jesus.
I got Madden 16 for PS4. So I'm a football fan. Greg, you should appreciate that.
I do, John.
Yes.
Have we ever talked about football?
Maybe offhand a couple of times.
You realize this conversation alone is going to trigger like 4 more. Hey, are you guys doing the NFL podcast email?
I know.
Again, the fear, the pride.
Yes. So I'll just touch briefly on it. You know, it's funny because...
Can you tell me what it's got to do with Scent of a Woman, John?
What is that joke? What am I missing?
It's a commercial with Colin Kaepernick as Al Pacino.
That's how this man's selling this game.
Ignore the game. He is a silly mini-movie.
I do not watch any Madden advertising.
It only came to my attention because Bill's head coach Rex Ryan gets killed in it.
Yeah, I saw something about Rex Ryan
bizarre.
About it.
It's really weird.
The ads for Madden 15 were completely absurd. I mean, they were just ridiculous.
These are weirder.
I'll probably watch
next
at some
year.
Point,
they'll go like full counter irony, counter irony by saying it's just Madden again.
No, you can tell
John Madden talking about football.
Nothing else in the tank to try to advertise this thing with. So
John, on that, tell us about Madden 16. What's new?
Madden 16, actually, you know, they do a good job. One of the things because I veered away. I used to play Madden a long time ago, but I completely veered away from the series because I kind of got tired of the treadmill of, well, we're going to reinvent the wheel every year just to change things
it's
up.
It's the hit stick.
Well, yeah. So, yeah, it's the hit stick. This time you can juke, and while you're juking, you can jump and do a jump juke. And then you can, while you're jump juking, you can do a duke and a deke and a dunk. And it's like, after a while, I was just like, it was just control overload. They tried to simulate every single thing that a player could possibly do in a game for no real reason.
The best part of that cycle was how each year they would come back and be like, last year was garbage. That game was terrible.
Yeah.
This year, you can now juke to the right.
Yeah.
This is the revolution. You're like, what are you doing?
Yeah. So, I mean, that kind of stuff I got kind of tired of it. But what they've done that I like is they hit you in the face with what has changed, the really relevant stuff right off the bat. So right when you load the game up, you're taken into training. And literally there is effectively a big button there that says, click on this to see what's new. And they take you through drills to show you exactly what's new, which completely makes sense. So, I mean, the main thing that they've changed this time around is they've added the ability to, like, when you catch the ball or when you defend the ball, you can determine what sort of catch or defense you're going to do. So when you catch, you know, you can I think triangle is aggressive. So it's kind of like leaping up to get the ball. Square is when I have to catch, and X is possession. So determining on kind of what you want the player to do when they catch the ball, like after they catch the ball, or kind of like, you know, like if you want somebody to just catch the ball and go down, nothing fancy, you know, you press X.
Are you one of those lazy people that never works back to the football, John?
I am. My quarterback has to find me.
Always
right?
pressing the after the catch button instead of just trying to help your quarterback out.
I completely do, though. Well, the thing is, what's funny, too, is that they come up with the icon that you should probably choose, and it's like, run after catch? Nah, I'm going to do aggressive, and I'm just sitting there spamming triangle.
John, what
you know,
what
regardless of where I am
a,
or what the situation
what button
is.
Gets you a 15-yarder for hit on a defensive receiver?
Anything, I think you'll find, because the NFL's for wusses now.
Anytime the defender actually
if the defender actually tries to play football, it's clearly a 15-yard flag.
Yeah, that's the same thing. I mean, you do the same thing when somebody throws. But I mean, you can. The thing is, what I like is that I mean, you can make the game kind of like the way you play it. You can kind of make it as complicated or as simple as you want. Like you don't like you like most times. Like you have the option of, because what I always used to do in Madden is I would take control of my player and just completely fuck the play up. Like take control of my player kind of unwittingly.
Stay
and
then in just, your like, lanes, John.
Yeah, just like run into the stands and the guy's like,
John,
oh, there's an 80-yard touchdown.
That's the wrong way.
Yeah, so. You know, you can, like, now you can pretty much just let the computer kind of, like, control your player. And then, you know, when the ball is in the air, that's when you kind of, you know, press the button to determine how the player behaves. That's closest to the ball. So
it's kind of like Geist. You just possess the player.
Oh,
God. Yeah, they bring up the bowl of dog food and, yeah. But,
great. So that's the new features in Madden, possession. Good. That's fantastic. So.
No, but I mean, but that's the thing though. At this point, that's all they can do really is just make little wrinkles like that. I mean, everything else is in there. You know, Madden Ultimate Team is really cool. Doing like the draft champions mode where, you know, you draft a Madden Ultimate Team and then kind of take it through, which is cool because you kind of have to choose, like when you draft, they give you three players to choose from and you kind of like figure out sort of, like I think, like my team is like, my quarterback's Eli Manning and then, and
you son of a bitch.
The blessed Eli.
You would
well, that's
come
the thing. Like,
here
you have to
and
choose.
Talk to me about Eli Manning.
Yes, absolutely.
Could have been Romo.
He's my boy.
No, because that would have been hilarious.
See, that's so what they kind of force you to do is they force you, like, you can, so what I did is when I took Eli, I was like, he's like 81.
Was Rex Grossman not available, John?
I wish. I got him in real life, so that's even better.
Is he taking out your trash?
So
he's on the Falcons roster, James.
So you know, Eli Manning, he's an 81, so I had to make the choice of whether I take him or wait to see if a better quarterback pops up. And the only guy that popped up after I took him was Joe Flacco, who was an 83, which is fine. But I was able to get my wideouts are Dez Bryant, Anquan Boldin, and then tight end is Vernon Davis. So it's just pretty much Dez Bryant. And that game is absolutely insane. That guy will catch anything you throw his way. He is absolutely insane. So.
Ever any controversial calls though? When he's
maybe a lawsuit or two. I don't know. But,
so who did you draft as Dez Bryant's fall guy?
I'm hoping to get the Chris Carter card in one of the packs I buy. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed for that one. Oh yeah, give me the Rookie Symposium pack, please. But
this is swerved so hard.
But Madden 16, it's a good time. I mean, if you like that, Madden 16, I mean, the thing is they've really, they've improved the way it's presented even more so than last year. So it's good. I mean, I like it. I didn't think I would ever get into Madden again, but here I am.
Does Gronkowski get to use his football cannon in the game?
No, I don't know, but I can tell he's a 91 and he's on my team. So God bless him. Even though I never use him, I never throw to that guy. But
you throw it to Vernon Davis instead.
Yeah, I'm throwing it to Dez Bryant. Well, he's on my Madden Ultimate team, not my Draft Champions team, but still.
The terminology's confused me. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's the thing. They're two different teams, but they both use like the Madden, like the kind of the football card kind of mechanic. My Madden Ultimate team, that's kind of like the more long-term sort of, you kind of build your team up and, you know, over time you get coins and you can buy them, you know, you buy packs and then you just try to assemble the best roster kind of thing.
So you're saying if you've taken a couple years off, maybe it's worth going back?
Yeah, I mean, it's good. I mean, I was pleasantly surprised with Madden 15. So, and I like it. I mean, I think it's a really good series now. Like, I'm really surprised that I've actually gotten back into it overall. You know, I remember people were asking me like, why don't you play Madden? And I'm like, well, it kind of sucks, but that's really not the case anymore. It's good.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, and I haven't looked them up, but I'm pretty sure that that series went through a fairly significant sales swoon from being EA's tentpole title. I mean, you can think back to what it was 10 years ago, even maybe 5 years ago, where their ESPN launch special, Madden, you know, 2012, where they've basically got a bunch of NFL players live playing Madden for the release of a video game about football, and you're thinking to yourself, where am I right now? But, you know, if there are people listening to the show who have stopped playing it in the last few years. So I guess if you did, maybe you should consider going back.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, cool. Well, that's going to do it for new business this week, unless anybody's going to drop something on me. We good?
I have no intention.
Okay.
I'm spent.
Fantastic. So that's going to do it for new business this week. And when we come back, we've got a feature about the end of a console lifecycle and the games released for it.
Morbid.
Well, no more morbid than having John draft Fall Guy for Des Bryant, so... Now Playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. Hey everybody, first up this week we have a review of Runbo on the Wii U eShop by Neil Ronahan. No longer content to merely be Forrest Gump's hometown in Alabama, Runbo has now been translated to the big screen as a goofy multi, and we mean multi, player platformer. See what Neil digs about it and what things make him angry, like Jordy tore an ACL angry. Wow. Nice. Some deep cuts there on that one, John.
Indeed, cuts. Surgery cuts.
Surgery cuts, yeah. There you go. We also have a review of 3D Gunstar Heroes on 3DS by Ryan Grove. You just heard our thoughts on this treasure classic, but find out what Ryan has to say about new additions like Gunslinger and Megalife modes. I mean, why would you believe us in our 443 episodes of educated opinions? Trust no one.
That's true.
I do want to point out that we actually talked about those modes.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
Okay, but we're just not trustworthy.
Yeah, exactly. That's my point, right?
To be fair, we aren't trustworthy.
This is true. All right, and we have a bunch of interviews from Gamescom 2015 by Don Koopman. Don puts down his kusage for a few minutes to attend Gamescom and conduct a series of developer interviews. He talks to Imogen Form about Steam World Heist on 3DS, Sheenan about Fast Racing Neo on Wii U, Two Tribes about Rive on Wii U, Simogo about Year Walk on Wii U, and Zoink about Zombie Vikings Arrival on Wii U. So if you're interested in any of those games, check out his interviews. They are fun and informational.
And trustworthy.
Indeed. We also have, speaking of not trustworthy, we also have a review of Devil's Third by, of course, Don Koopman.
Only the finest.
Yep. He doesn't stay away from the kusage for long, though, as he takes a bullet for all of us by giving this controversial Itagaki creation a try. It's a bit of a mess, but how big? How does it compare to, say, Flappin' Zagata? Which Don gave a 1, by the way. A 1. Read his review to find out.
All this and more 1s are available to you. Well, on the Wii U eShop, actually. But you can read about them at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Flappin' Zagata.
Flappin' Zagata for Smash. Welcome back. We're going to forego listener mail this week because we wanted to talk about some news and we wanted to talk about some end of console lifespan video game releases and kind of do a little reflection on that. But I'm going to go ahead and put the email plug in first. Even though we're not doing email this week, we've still got an email-shaped hole in our hearts that we need you to fill. And you can fill it by sending us an email to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We'll peg that again at the end. And it's always in the show notes if you want to look it up. Well, first up in this section, we're going to talk about some news that came out this week. Nintendo of Europe and Nintendo of America, and I guess Nintendo of Australia as well, all put out their press release this week detailing their release plans for the remainder of the year. The date, and they tied dates to most of the content. There may be one or two things there that are just given windows, but I'm pretty sure pretty much everything got dates. No real surprises jump out at us here. Some stuff that we had kind of assumed got confirmed, like Devil's Third is going to be digital only in North America. Is anybody angry? You could...
No.
Project Zero is digital only in North America. Some people are actually angry about that one. In Europe, it's the only edition is the limited edition. Everything else is digital only.
Yeah, that's, I mentioned that last week. But it, so in America, it's just straight, Fatal Frame is just straight up digital with the try the first two chapters, I yep. believe, before you get. I presumably there's an in-game kind of prompt to go and buy the rest of it.
Pay for the rest. There's a things that jumped out at me. There's a Super Mario Maker bundle. I'm a little bit surprised about that one, but I mean, it makes sense. It's Walmart exclusive and comes with the quote modern colors 8-bit Mario amiibo. $300. It's a little pricey. Guess that might shoot our there's a price drop coming this year answer from last week in the foot, but we'll see. Mm-hmm. We got prices on, you know, the Animal Crossing Happy House Arrest. You know, it's, you know, like I said, there's nothing really that jumps out of here. The new Super Mario U, new Super Luigi U bundle.
Right, which some people were like, wait, don't I already have that on my shelf? And turns out, like, this CD, this DVD already existed, but it was only ever bundled.
Right.
So now, finally, they're releasing it at retail.
Yep, that new Super Mario U bundle that had new Super Luigi Brothers in it is mm-hmm. the same disc, essentially.
Right.
But this is the first time you could buy it if you managed to pass on both of them, which that makes that a lot of freaking Mario on one disc.
It is.
But it's not Infinite Mario because that's coming out September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
Anything
but
else?
They got Mario for you.
They got, if you've got a hankering for some Mario, some 2D Mario specifically. We got some amiibo dates. John, I know you're excited.
Oh, I'm putting that on the calendar right now.
But we've got one for Greg. Greg, are you buying the Mega Yarn Yoshi amiibo?
No, probably not. It's too big.
It's too much big. Yoshi.
I was kind of surprised by that. It's a bit odd that that's coming, because obviously we already had the Yarn Yoshi amiibo come out, whereas like in America it won't be that much longer after Yoshi's Woolly World comes out, because I think it's the middle of November that the Mega one's coming out. But yeah, it looks nice, and it actually has like hard plastic eyes that more closely replicate the cover art. You know, like instead of them being stitched on, they're actually sort of, you know, like a meant to look like a sort of a bead that's been sewn in. So yeah, it looks high quality and all that, but that is going to be way too rich for my blood.
It is very expensive.
I think the little ones are cuter, but for kids, like as a cuddly toy, it's eminently more cuddleable than the very small one. So I get it.
You know, not to overly celebrate here, but it does make me start to lean towards maybe Nintendo really is going to start just making toys and sticking the tag in it. Because, I mean, it's really not useful as an amiibo in and of itself, because it's just too big. I mean, like,
right.
You're not going to be able to tap that on your gamepad. It's enormous.
I was really hoping that they would go the character card route first before going the mega character $40 US, $60 Canadian amiibo. I wanted, like, cheap, affordable amiibos, basically, just in case. But turns out you don't really need them for anything, so I don't even need the cards.
So, Guillaume, I'll give you a piece of advice that makes that much more approachable. Make more money. Obviously, that's the problem. Make more money, get a bigger apartment.
You were the guy at Sony that
yeah,
said that.
You will work extra hours for your
get a
life,
second job so you can buy a
for
PS3,
your life-size Yoshi amiibo.
Yeah.
That's actually possibly the biggest
and
news
then
that
was,
came
there,
out.
There was this was different. The Shovel Knight amiibo leak that struck people
today.
People in Britain can't keep their Twitters shut, apparently, and something
I like
that presumably is going to be revealed at PAX, which is obviously going to be kind of going on.
It's going on as we record, actually.
In between, us recording and publishing this episode, they leaked that. But then, like, Nintendo leaked stuff by putting videos up on their channel early, so.
It's true, they did.
You can't just blame the Brits.
So the Nindies at Home event is going on right now, actually, the evening event, and one of the things that Nintendo screwed up by posting to YouTube, which I understand how it happens, the default is public, and if you don't set that thing before it finishes uploading, it's gonna go public, was the release of Kerbal Space Program on the Wii U eShop, which means this show will transform into the Kerbal Space Program podcast, hosted by me and me alone, because I'm not sure it's going to be a solo.
It's going to be a James Jones joint right there.
It's going to be like that episode that Carl did by himself.
It's going to be me going, guys, I made it to Minmus with no rockets. You don't even know how I did it. It's crazy. I broke the shit out of this game. I did appreciate, though, that the trailer that they so haphazardly released and then pulled down, which is appropriate for that game, because that's pretty much how you do everything, primarily features things going wrong. So at least they understand what the appeal of that game is.
Yeah, I had a laugh at the one rocket landing, and you just know the rocket's just going to hit the pad and just explode, but they stop it just before it hits the pad.
Right, and which, if you've played the game, you know that also means his pad got destroyed.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. Yeah. But, I mean, like I said, there wasn't a whole lot of news out of the press release, just a lot of dates. Any dates that jump out at anybody here? There's some stuff that's multi-date drops.
Well, for me, we got a UK press release, and in there it has a Xenoblade Chronicles X limited edition pack.
It does.
That has the game, steelbook, art book, map, and poster, and that is not coming to the US, as far as I know.
It is not, as far as you know.
Yeah, because this is something they did, with, like, Last Story and Pandora's Tower. They both got steelbook limited editions. Back at the end of the Wii's life cycle, so I guess they feel like it's something it must have worked out for them in that time.
And that's kind of burns.
I think it's December 5th. Is it the date for 4th. That? UK maybe.
December 4th. Yep. is Xenoblade X, and then it's in all regions.
All right, yeah. So that's pretty cool. But I mean, I guess for me, the bigger thing was not so much all of the news, which is mostly kind of housekeeping stuff, sort of just taking us a little bit on from where we were after the end of E3, but just the way they did it, the fact that it was just kind of a press release dump rather than any kind of dressing it up with a direct or anything like that. I'm not sure what that says about the future of that. The form of communication in the post-Iwata period at Nintendo, but it may be that they're sort of just taking some time to kind of reboot it, and kind of give it some space, due respect to obviously the monumental event that is the passing of the program.
I mean, they may very well be trying to figure out who's actually going to do it,
Right.
Instead of having somebody just fill in or have it constantly changed, maybe have somebody do it permanently or something.
Yeah, I mean, this press release, for those of us who have been doing the Nintendo news game for a while, feels very much like a press release we would have gotten quarterly, about 4 years ago. We'd get one of these every quarter, it would be a grid, and it would have game, date, price, game, date, price, game, date, price, and it would just continue through, and occasionally you'd get one that has some notes about, like, comes with a steelbook or stuff like that. And, this is not something they had done much in the Nintendo Direct era, or it would come in supplement to a Nintendo Direct.
Right.
So seeing it on its own definitely makes me think that, to Greg's point, at the very least, that either out of respect or just out of not feeling comfortable being able to produce it right now, that they've set it aside. But I think Nintendo's had a lot of success communicating with their fan base directly and cutting us out of that equation. So I would I would assume that's going to come back.
Yeah,
at some point.
I can't imagine it'll be the end of them, but perhaps it will be a significant retooling, and it might be somewhat different when they come back rather than just a new front man. It might be a bit more substantial than that, but we'll see.
Yep. But I kind of like that news came out today because it syncs very nicely with a topic that Greg had broached about doing a special feature on, and we'd wanted to do more features on in the second act because we'd kind of gotten into the email and occasionally retroactive game, and it seems like a good time to talk about games that come out at the end of a life cycle of a console.
Yeah, are you saying that the Wii U is dying here? Is that what you're saying? It's dead? Because I'll remind you that Pokken Tournament Fighters, or whatever it's called,
that's
coming out in 2016. All right,
that's at least two more games buying for this system.
Genne Ibunroku Sharp FE is coming out in 2016.
Quit it with your pig Latin.
I don't know how you even managed to get that.
I don't speak Spanish, James.
But
I didn't take Japanese for 4 years, Craig.
But come on, still, that's just nonsense. That. It's not in any language, it's nonsense. The idea was more about 3DS, to be honest, in terms of it's been around for 4.5 years now, and kind of the way that I was thinking about the end of a hardware cycle is, broadly speaking, there's big differences, because every every generation had its own set of circumstances, but generally thinking about a year and a half out from when its, you know, successor, its sort of replacement device would arrive on the market. And I think it's pretty clear that there will be a replacement for the 3DS within the, you know, a year and a half or so, because, you know, you've seen what they've done with the new 3DS. They're just trying to basically gin up sales a bit with a new iteration, much like they did with DSi, although obviously the DS again was a more successful cycle. But, you know, that time is not far off now. It's been 4.5 years. We've had plenty of good games. I imagine we've got quite a few more to come, but it got me thinking about, you know, how different this kind of period is that we're entering now, that we're just in now with the 3DS and maybe indeed the Wii U or both, because NX might replace both of them. We don't know, but
right. You know. And we talk a lot about the start of a console cycle.
Yeah, there's always like the best launch titles, or, you know, that
the worst
kind of
launch
stuff.
Titles,
the stuff that, like, you know, the killer apps, the stuff that sold people on a console, you know, that won a console war or something like that. But, you know, the end is often quieter. There's some really, really great games in there as well, especially when I was kind of compiling some of my favorite games on each of the Nintendo platforms over the years. Some of which I played, you know, contemporaneously, others I did not. But, yeah, there's some really great games, but I think also there's a change often that happens in the types of games that show up for various different reasons. It's just some of these sorts of issues I thought would be kind of interesting to discuss in a feature. So I get the first thing I want us to do is go through sequentially all the sort of the platforms and name off some of our favourite late era games of using that rough kind of 18 months time frame. So we'll start with the NES. And John, have you got some favourite late era NES games that you'd like to share?
Yes, I would say. John, thank you for compiling this list that you've put together. It's very helpful.
See, that's the thing with me with the NES. I moved over to the Super NES pretty quickly, so a lot of these I didn't play. But I would say stuff like Gargoyle's Quest 2 was really good.
Yes, I've got that one.
Yeah, and like what you find is near the end, you know, you have a lot of sequels to really good games. DuckTales 2 was good. Chippendale Rescue Rangers, like those Capcom games, were really good.
Ninja Gaiden 3?
Yes, Ninja Gaiden 3. Yep, and I mean, really, kind of, if you consider 91 late era, probably my favorite
Super Nintendo was, you know, already been in Japan.
True.
Super Nintendo was in 1990. In America, it was the summer of 91. So I think that's legit. And don't forget as well, obviously, we're doing this from a Nintendo perspective, but, you know, they weren't in a vacuum. You know, the Mega Drive or the Genesis, they were on the market. The TurboGrafx was on the market. You know, so I think it's legit. 1990, I would definitely say, is late era.
Well, then Mario 3. I mean, that's 1990.
Well, 1990 actually had a number of huge games for the NES. River City Ransom, Super Mario Bros. 3, Final Fantasy, Ninja Gaiden 2, Rad Racer 2, Castlevania 3. They had huge games coming out in 1990.
It had very rich kind of end to it.
But after that, that's when things start getting really dialed back. So 1990 was really the last hurrah, and then things slowly start getting dialed back. But I have to say, 91, one of my favorite games of all time, Tecmo Super Bowl. Absolutely love that game.
Absolutely. And it makes sense, because the Japanese developers had already switched over to Super Nintendo, because in their market, that was what was out, Super Famicom.
Yep.
So because there was, you know, somewhat significant lag time there, and because the Famicom had such a huge install base, the games kept coming out into 94.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's got quite a sort of afterlife, if you like, the NES. I mean, you got certain first-party titles, Kirby's Adventure is a big one, one of the latter ones that a lot of people really like. The sort of more obscure game didn't come out in America, but it's been talked about on this show for a bit, is Euphoria, the saga, which in Japan is Hebereke from Sunsoft. I ended up playing that on the Virtual Console, and I really quite enjoyed that. You've got a really interesting one in terms of just showing, like, how far they'd come with what you could do on a Famicom or NES by the end, was the Summer Carnival Wrecker game.
Yes.
That's on 3DS Virtual Console, which is a vertical shooter, sort of in the mold of those vertical shooters that were on the TG-16 at the time, which is obviously a more powerful system, but it does a really admirable job of pushing the NES to do some crazy stuff. And that's the thing. I mean, when you think that it started as a Famicom in 83, and then you've got, you know, some of these kind of major games or, you know, really much more advanced games coming out almost 10 years later. It's kind of a life cycle unlike any other. It's really, really, I mean, there's some common threads, I think, with the trends that you could see that play out in subsequent generations, but nothing's quite like the Famicom NES era.
Yeah, and it's, in a way, it's kind of a throwback to things that had happened in the previous console generations, because I think there were 2600 games coming out three generations of Atari systems later.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because they released a new system every 2 years.
Because I kept shooting them in the back of the head. But, yeah. But like, it's kind of, you know, it wasn't really until the Super Nintendo generation, the Genesis generation, started to fade that, you know, the generations became much more discreet and there was less of this bleed over.
Like, and, so, I mean, right. I think to your point, James, the lag in terms of the localization, the difference in the markets played more of a role as well. I mean, in Japan, the Famicom kept making first party games like for quite a while. There's that Joy Mech fight, that crazy fight.
Yes.
Street Fighter 2 type of thing, you know, on NES with these sort of compound sprites of robots and stuff. It's mental. But, you know, it was compounded in the West because, you know, there's so much, especially Europe. I mean, so much stuff hadn't come. I don't think we got Mario 3 until like 92 or something ridiculous. I mean,
yeah.
we were on some sort of crazy lag over here. So, you know, that kind of dragged things out. Really.
I've got one on Super Nintendo we're going to get to.
Oh, have you got any? What about NES first? Or just
well, yeah, yeah. I'm just saying on that particular point, we'll blow your mind how long Europe took to get a game. But I actually really, I mean, if we're going, you know, 91, 92, like I really enjoy, within reason, Dragon Warrior 3. Although, you know, it's, you know, the game, I don't feel like it's aged super well, but, you know, I enjoyed for what it was.
Did you ever play 4? Because 4 came out in 92.
Don't think
that's
rare.
That's one I wish that they would put on the virtual console.
But like the infamous Wario Woods,
yeah,
last official game.
Neil likes it apparently.
It's fine.
Also, the only NES game to have an ESRB rating.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the eternal trivia question game.
Yeah, I mean, think about it this way though. Think about where the character Wario is now fully developed enough that they felt like it could have his own game. And it's on the NES, which tells you how long the NES kept going.
Yeah.
Right.
94. I mean, that was when Super Metroid came out, so.
Yes. You're starting to get into mid to late Super Nintendo time at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Personally, like, I never had an NES, so the last game that I remember people really talking about buying and playing is Battletoads, really. So I think 1991 was basically the cutoff year for a lot of my friends, and then people had moved on to the Super Nintendo.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting point, though, actually, because Rare, you know, who don't really, you know, they don't really feature that much in the early 16-bit. Kind of era, you know, we think of them showing up with DKC like kind of midway through, but a lot of it's because they were still doing a hell of a lot of NES stuff late on, you know. Yeah. They were kind of like the premier Western developer making NES games, and they kind of stuck with that for quite a few years.
Yeah. And they had jumped on a little bit late onto the NES because they had been making stuff for, you know, British-focused, you know, home computers.
Yeah, well, right. I mean, later than the Japanese developers, naturally, who, you know, were doing all the arcade, but early compared to other Western developers.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Yeah,
so, you know, I mean, that's the other thing is that, you know, again, the difference with it because, you know, the home console industry was still kind of, it is sort of almost nascent kind of period. You know, it was very different back then in terms of the way that the Japanese developers just totally dominated the output on the NES. And it was, especially in Europe, you know, you kind of had this, you know, the home computer scene was very big and all that. It was quite a bit of resistance to Nintendo mania.
Actually, I'm going to retract that statement because I think RC Pro-Am was 87. So, And yeah, then, like I said, they got Cobra Triangle.
They did get in early, you know, compared to certainly their contemporaries, much, much earlier. They demonstrated that they, I think Slalom, wasn't it, as well, was an earlier one. You know, they got in there very early and made it, you know, their own, but they stuck with it as well, you know, and that kind of put them on a bit of a cycle where they would be a feature of late generation Nintendo games until they got sold to Microsoft, basically.
Because I think 90, they dropped like 3 or 4 games, and then they maybe did one a year until they basically didn't come out until Killer Instinct Gold. I mean, there was a big window there between like an RC Pro-Am 2 and KI. Like there's some other stuff in there too, but like it's like there was I guess the Donkey Kong games, for example. But
yeah,
like,
the DK games. Obviously, it's different things about like what did they publish, what did Nintendo publish,
right?
You know, but in terms of the development work, you know, there was they didn't kind of really make themselves known in the 16-bit scene until DKC. But that's definitely one kind of common thread that you can draw. But no, I mean, I think maybe. Yeah, the later era games, you know, they had, because of the cartridges, the way that, you know, you had different like Castlevania 3, John mentioned, you know, some stuff that, well, at least in Japan, you had these additional custom processors that made the music way better, could make the graphics better. You know, the late games were very, I mean, of course, today we have launch titles and then games look a lot better, but the kind of sort of quantum leaps that you would get within one hardware cycle were very, very different at this point.
Yeah.
And so that's why maybe they're not like the absolute vintage of the era. You know, it's not The Legend of Zelda or something like that. You know, so that sort of genre defining and classic, these later games, but they are really good and vibrant and just impressive to this day if you have appreciation for the technology of that time.
Oh yeah. I mean, there are like a lot of them use kind of the same engine, but very refined gameplay wise. And like you said, they usually, you know, added chips to the cartridges for graphical flourishes and stuff like that. So,
and I think one key thing that went through some of the early consoles as well was that, you know, the arcade scene existed and was very important during this period.
Yeah, and very influential.
And of course, you know, trying to ape the arcades was a big deal, but as a system got later into its life, it was not that was not really the most viable way to do it anymore. So as the software tends to drift more into sort of specifically home console kind of oriented stuff as it goes on, I think certainly RPGs generally tend to figure quite large at the end of some of these console cycles. You know, so they get away from like, okay, let's put a racing game or a fighting game or, you know, this kind of just to show what the system could do kind of stuff. You know, that fades away at the end.
And those games already existed. A lot of times they were ports of games that existed versus these big RPGs that, of course, took a long time to make.
Exactly. And additional localization delays in those days.
Yes.
I mean, we still have them now, but, you know, like, they're really chubby back then. So they would land towards the end. And in some cases, we were deprived of them altogether because of that problem.
Yeah. And I would say
Enigma
I guess that's a good transition point because Super Nintendo is replete.
Before, like, can we not skip Game Boy because it's an aberration?
Game Boy is going to be. I know it's. We're going to do Game Boy after Super Nintendo. That's all. And
That is so mental, though, because I was done with Game Boy basically when the Super Nintendo came out.
But that's not when it ended. That's
no. The Game Boy's life cycle is the most challenging to sort of define because it kind of had two. Very odd, but I think Super Nintendo we will tackle first, and then we'll tackle the whole Game Boy Color.
Because that's a good transition because so many of the things that came out late are RPGs, and you know, big ones, really impressive games. So for me, you know, one of my favorite RPGs of all time, Lufia 2, Rise of the Sinestros.
Earthbound, of course, James.
Lufia 2, Rise of the Sinestrals, came out in 96.
Square were incredibly prolific as well. They were doing lot of stuff that didn't get localized around this sort of time. Like Bahamut Lagoon and all this. I mean, they you know, don't forget, PlayStation Saturn were, what, 94? So, but they're still producing, like, these sort of top production value Super Famicom games in 96.
So, this is the game I was teasing on. Lufia 2 came out in late 97 in Europe.
I'm amazed that it came out at all. I mean, we didn't get Chrono Trigger. We didn't get Earthbound. Like, we didn't get these games in general. That is news to me.
Yeah, this game came out super late.
Yeah, so the Super Nintendo, I actually got very late in its life. The bundle with Donkey Kong Country existed, and I dismissed it.
That advanced computer modeling graphics got you on board,
right.
Eh?
No, actually, I instead of getting that with two controllers, I was like, well, I'm going to get the cheaper model without a game, and I'm going to get Super Metroid with it. So I must have bought it like 94. That meant that I was just swimming in great games. Like, I borrowed, of course, all the Link to the Past and stuff like that from friends and Final Fantasy VI. But for Christmas, like, I got Chrono Trigger and Yoshi's Island and,
you're reading off my list here.
Yeah, no, but I got all those games, you know, like,
Fight!
And Tetris Attack was a big game for some reason because Yoshi's Island was so good, I guess. I was like, oh yeah, okay. I like Yoshi. I'm going
to
get this Tetris Attack game.
Some of the weirdest branding ever to take.
I know, but it was such a good...
To put Yoshi on it, but then don't put the Yoshi name on it. Put Tetris name on it, even though it's not Tetris. It's
right.
Like, perfectly good game.
So, and so you won't be able to ever release it.
It sucks
because it's got such great music. And,
the Panel de Pon, the game that's based on, is on the Japanese Wii Virtual Console.
Of course it is. And we're probably going to get Pokemon Puzzle League here, but it's not the same. It's just not the same. Different hardware, you don't get the slowdown that allows you to cheat and win. it makes
great.
It so satisfying.
Fantastic.
You hear all the thunking, like the sounds that the blocks make when they disappear, and when the game slows down and nothing is happening on your side of the screen, you're like, oh shit, I'm about to get a mega garbage block dumped on my screen soon.
It's downloading the garbage right now.
Yeah. but I find that Super Nintendo, I was never really an early supporter and early adopter of consoles before I started podcasting, basically. So
it became your
late
job.
Adopter of Super Nintendo. I think that it's a good time to get a system. You know, like you get such a vast choice of games, and you get usually the consoles have been severely discounted, or they you get a better bundle than you would have.
Yeah.
And sure, you might end up missing on kind of the early stuff, like the GameCube. I didn't play Luigi's Mansion until way late because it was kind of passé, you know, like it was kind
sure.
of... it was not a game that you would be necessarily drawn to go back to once stuff like Mario Sunshine or Metroid Prime had come out. But I think
see
that
fine N64 Bowser model in the game.
Yeah. So it was a good time to get a system, and now, you know, like jumping forward in time, like that's kind of changed because Nintendo doesn't do price drops anymore.
Well, unless they're very much forced to by, you know, some very drastic circumstances.
Right. They put the price drops at the beginning of a generation when the 3DS is stalling.
I mean, Super Nintendo, I think, has got to be my favorite generation close. I mean, we talked about Game Boy, but Super Nintendo has a little bit of a second life because of DKC, you know, in the Western markets anyway. Yeah, that gave it the sort of shot in the arm, and also kind of helped it fight off obsolescence being imposed upon it by the 32-bit consoles that were coming out. You know, so it did give it kind of a more vibrant sort of late period than most. And you know, you're talking about some of the absolute classics on the system, like Chrono Trigger, Yoshi's Island. I mean, they're right up there with the very best games on the system for me. And then, I mean, some others that are very good. Super Mario RPG appeared, was the last Super Nintendo game I ever bought. before the N64 came along. There was a lot of good stuff that naturally that didn't come over from Japan. We talked about the Square stuff, but one of my favorites is the fourth Gunbare Goemon game, which is a tremendous amount of fun, gorgeous, great music. The only thing down point on it is that it doesn't have the impact battles that the second and third games and then the N64 games have gone to have. But there was just some incredible work being done at the end of the Super Nintendo era. I think it's tough to beat. You had Nintendo's first party stuff. They were still coming out with some really good first party games like Kirby again, which again, it was kind of the fact that Kirby, you know, started on Game Boy and then Kirby's Adventure was a really late NES game kind of put it on a cycle that Kirby would become a fixture of late. See, you know, that is one of the people one of the characters I really associate with the end of a console.
I mean, Kirby Dream Land 3 came out in 97.
Yeah, Dream Land 3. I mean, Superstar was quite late, as Guillaume mentioned, but Dream Land 3 is 97. I mean, that's well into N64 territory at that point. So, you know, I mean, he's like their late game man, Kirby. But
the first Harvest Moon came out in 97 as well.
But something that you would read in Nintendo Power about. Some games I never played, but Nintendo Power, I guess, was desperate to pad up their. Well, they were not. Sorry.
No, I mean that's a legitimately good game. Like,
right.
I mean, let's not sell that game short.
Okay, sorry, but like we were getting types of games weren't getting usually or weren't getting before, and it was just weird reading about them in Nintendo Power, just like. You're talking about the simulation where you raise up a robot and or something, and then that would turn out to not come out in North America. But then stuff like Harvest Moon would. It was just a weird time to be reading these magazines and to see what made it through, what didn't. And usually there weren't not genres of games that we were used to seeing on consoles or... You know, like not action-oriented. Like we weren't getting Zelda, weren't getting Mario, we're getting... You know, a farm sim.
Yeah, I mean, Harvest Moon. If I would have seen that game at the time, I would have said, "Yeah, that's just one of those weird Japanese games that they bring over because they don't have anything else. It'll be here for like two games. You know, they'll probably release something, you know, to follow it up in the same franchise, and then it'll be gone forever."
Well, I mean, the thing I think is that you would have been able to make that statement because there was a much better awareness of what was out there, essentially that. We as consumers in the West were becoming more aware of what was being created in Japan. True. That up until that point, there had been some of that, but it hadn't penetrated into the media as deeply.
Yeah, so, and that changed with the advent of the interwebs as well.
Well, even before that, like Nintendo Power would make an effort to show these games off, but I think they were starting to become aware of the fact that they don't necessarily know what was going to get published here, so they would just start showing stuff early. And maybe that was part of the analysis campaign of, you know, this game got shown, people seemed excited about it, okay, maybe we'll bring it over. Because it wouldn't be as easy to do these kinds of broad-based focus testing that they can do now for innumerable reasons. But ultimately, that, you know, that sort of becomes, you know, the verve of the Super Nintendo. You get these things that are coming out and they're just with the NES, it was everything was new because everything was new. You could only do so much on the predecessor systems. You know, if you were in home computer territory, if you had, you know, some of these things that had come out, you know, maybe you got to see this stuff, like if you had a Commodore, but most families didn't. This was really the first time most people were playing games in their homes that weren't garbage, because everything on the Atari is garbage.
Which, yeah.
I mean, everything. Go back and play literally anything on the Atari. If it's not freaking Pitfall or Tubin. It's bad. Like it's almost it's almost unrecognizable what you are doing if you look at those games. Like
I think the biggest
Tubin's a good game, asshole.
The biggest thing about the NES and Super NES eras for me when they come to their close is that, you know, this was a time when Nintendo, like I said, they had some Kirby, they had some big kind of really nice late era releases, but you know the third parties could bring out so much because there was a time when third parties were very prevalent on Nintendo platforms and, you know, they were the only game in town in Japan completely.
Right.
And, you know, had very good market positions in North America at least. You know, you would have, you know, some Japanese stuff that might be coming out a bit late and all that. And then you'd have the more Western influence, you know, the sports titles and all that kind of thing. So you had this big line of late game things that just, you know, would really make it a lot easier to enjoy yourself with fresh content in the late period, even if you had bought the system at the start, you know, and been sort of gradually mopping up all the games as they went along. Obviously, that would change once we get to like the N64 period and all that. But you know, I think we'll go to the handheld stuff now, as we kind of teased.
Yeah,
the difficulty
right.
with defining this is really interesting.
Yeah, so like I was done with the Game Boy after the first Wario Land came out, and Zelda, and I don't know, like Mega Man 5, I guess. Like that must have been around 93, 94.
So
I was just like, okay, that's it for the Game Boy. I'm ready to move on to something else.
And that's like
and that
5
must have
years
been...
after it came out, so it's a good. Right. You know, it'd been on the market for a while, and Nintendo had hit a lot of its major franchises at that point. The third party guys that were big on the NES had brought theirs over, like Mega Man, Castlevania. You know, it felt like it had a complete life, and then something
right.
happened.
They had brought over their action franchises. That is the distinction. Because we've talked about this on the show a bunch of times, and I am the foremost evangelist on the show that the Game Boy had two, maybe three lives. Everything in an AD sort of situation is before Pokemon and after Pokemon.
But, yeah. James, I was playing Link to the Link's Awakening.
That's
I
not
was
an
playing
RPG.
Final. No, but Final Fantasy Adventure, Final Fantasy Legend 2, Legend 3, like, I had a bunch, and I was aware that Ultima games were on the system. And,
they're different, though. Those Ultima games, they don't play like the normal Ultima games. They're
sure. Just like the NES games, but still, like, they were RPGs.
No, but there's a difference. After that game comes out, you start seeing a lot of RPGs. And you see a lot of Pokemon clones. And
right.
it's... There's this weird moment that, like, the Game Boy becomes marketable again. Mm-hmm. And Nintendo is on top of it. They're releasing, you know, new hardware revisions, and they're really pushing it. Then, you know, hot on the heels of Pokemon, you get the Game Boy Color. And you get the Pokemon games that take advantage of the Game Boy Color. And then you get this surge of licensed games, because you can now depict the license in color, which is incredibly important if you're a license holder, that the game at least in some way reflect the license, and color gives you way more tools to do that. And then you see a big surge of these more long-form games that come, these less action-y focused games. And the Game Boy Color sort of becomes this weird place where you start to see NES games get re-released. I mean,
that's true. It had its little kind of equivalent of what the GBA would do in its early period, where it was
really bad ports of NES games,
but of the resolution,
tragically terrible NES ports.
The resolution was a big stumbling block for playing things accurately.
More successful were like the up ports of Game Boy games. So you got Link's Awakening DX and Tetris DX.
Yep.
But yeah, it's funny because I was like maybe 13 when I was done with a Game Boy. Like, okay, I played Wario Land, I'm fine. And then two more come out, but years later, and like I'm in college when I get a Game Boy Color. It was really, really weird.
Yeah, it came back into vogue.
Yeah, so I mean, if we're going to start with just the baseline Game Boy, I would argue that like Pokemon Yellow, that's like one of the last... true Game Boy game.
But that was years after I was done with it.
I know.
Like, no, that's the way it is. I think it is it is legitimately, I mean, I think you could say that games before Pokemon came out were legitimately late Game Boy games. Like, it felt like it was winding down.
So
and then,
did Pokemon
like
Red and Blue,
Busby 2.
Did they seriously come out in North America in 1998? Holy shit.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was a whole 2 years, I think.
Pokemon Yellow came out in 1999.
That's fuck. That blows my mind.
And right on the heels, the Game Boy Color comes out.
Oh, man. No, that's the kind of the weird part of it. I mean, just that, you know, the Game Boy gets this huge shot in the arm, and then they bring out another one.
Well, I mean, in a way, it kind of made sense, though, because, okay, you bought your Game Boy Pockets to play. Here's a Game Boy Color. Like... oh shit, look at all this stuff. And here's a Pokemon game to go with it. And it's got twice as many Pokemon. Go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Back when twice as many Pokemon wasn't a threat, it was a promise.
No, I mean, it's a remarkable kind of thing. And I think, like, what James says, though, is very relevant. It's what I was talking about, the evolution of the kinds of games on the platform. Pokemon was just a sort of tectonic sized shift in, you know, this second life that the Game Boy had. Yes, it had RPGs before, but then it's going to have a hell of a lot more, and a hell of a lot more of a certain kind from that point on. Whereas, you know, in the early stages, a lot of what Game Boy was about was mimicking home experiences, you know, maybe in a limited fashion, which, you know, again, early phase Game Boy Color did that too.
Right. It was things like Primal Rage and, like, Jungle Strike.
But, yeah, you know, as it went on, I think, you know, it got...
To quote my Game Boy collection.
It got more confident about making use of the portable medium. I mean, one of the late Game Boy games I've come to enjoy, you know, through the virtual console is Mole Mania, you know, is kind of very much a portable game. I couldn't imagine, you know, Nintendo making that for a console. But it's, you know, just a kind of sort of a little bit similar to sort of Zelda puzzle solving, but just with nothing else, you know. So it's, you know, I think that's a really cool kind of game where they had decided to let, you know, the platform kind of stand on its own merits rather than, oh, it's like that thing that's real gaming, but it's in your hands, you know?
Right.
And then Pokemon just kind of defined that in a whole other way after that.
I guess I don't see this shift because when I had my Game Boy, I was playing Link's Awakening, I was playing Wario Land. When I picked up the Game Boy Color, I played two more of Link's Awakening, you know, same sprites.
More Wario Land.
And I got a new Wario Land game.
No, but I think that's the thing. I mean, like, Link's Awakening and Wario Land are like 93. Like, in a way, that is late Game Boy.
Right.
You know, absolutely. I mean, I think Pokemon just kind of extended that period. I mean, that's what I'm talking about. I think, you know, the maturation process for the Game Boy, you know, happened in the early 90s. And that's what I'm saying. I mean, you've got games which, in a way, could be considered like late era Game Boy games about 5 years before it actually keeled over. So that's why I'm saying the whole 18 months there, I kind of talked about at the front, is kind of a bit fluid because the Game Boy is a totally special case, it's a total outlier. But we'll hold that over because N64 is next. And very different picture from the previous consoles that we talked about.
Well, the third parties were gone.
Very much absent.
Rare in Nintendo.
Exactly.
What was there was shit.
Well, you know, one thing I will say, the third parties.
The one
sort of distinguishing feature here is there was actually more Western third parties churning stuff out at the end than there were Japanese ones, because it was a particular sort of flop in Japan in relative terms. Whereas in America, you know, stuff like GoldenEye and, you know, it kind of did okay. Relatively, so you did have like the sports games and Turok 3 and stuff like that coming out late. It wasn't quite entirely bereft of third party games, but the stuff we remember is pretty much all Nintendo in this case. But they are really, really good. Some of this stuff are absolute favorite games on the system.
2000 was really.
2000 was an insane year. So Nintendo had gotten into this streak, especially in 2000, of there's going to be an N64 game that you want to play every month. And that was sort of the compact they had made with people who were hanging on. And, you know, every month you were going to get a game that you go, whoa, this game is really cool. But that was your game for the month. So if that game didn't interest you, you know, your N64 game of the month club card was being wasted that month.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but I mean, 2000, I mean, the list I made up was Banjo-Tooie, Excitebike 64, Kirby 64 The Crystal Shards, Majora's Mask, Mario Tennis, Mickey's Speedway USA.
This is all 1 year.
All in 1 year. Paper Mario, Perfect Dark, Pokemon Puzzle League, Pokemon Stadium 2, Sin and Punishment. I had StarCraft 64 on there just because that just seems so fucking odd right now.
Remember.
That seems really weird.
I am an owner of that game.
So I put that down, StarCraft 64, Tony Hawk's Pro Skater, Turok 3, Shadow of Oblivion, and WWF No Mercy, which is fucking amazing.
That's another thing that was really big on N64 Hacking in the games. Western markets. You know, the wrestling games, the Tony Hawk, you know, like that was, yep. that's the difference. It had like a much more Western kind of character to it at this point.
Well, even though Aki made those WWE.
Yeah, I know,
games
but in terms
in
of
Japan,
the actual taste.
Makers of Style, you know, Savvy, by the way, if you didn't know that. That's what
oh,
they do
wow.
now.
Yes. Nice. But I mean, you know, Sin and Punishment, Majora's Mask, Perfect Dark, you know, these are some of my favorite games on the console, you know, and to go back to kind of the point, you know, similar to what we talked about with NES, Super NES, you know, there was the technical improvements, you know, that, you know, you get cartridges with more memory, with more, you know, the processors and all this kind of stuff. Well, that happened with the N64 as well, of course, and you had like the RAM expansion pack came in a little bit, and not many games really used it, and all that. But I think more to the point, just people got more comfortable with designing 3D games. You know, so
right.
That's why I think a lot of the games, you know, at the end of that life cycle are some of the best ones. I mean, obviously stuff like Super Mario 64 and Ocarina of Time are the sort of, you know, the kind of era defining classics. But, you know, in terms of the like really polished and just great designs, I think there's quite a few really good ones. And then you've got like Conker comes in, like was one of the last games, which.
Yeah, that's in 2001. The only ones I really had on there was Animal Crossing, Bomberman 64, which was really good, and Conker's Bad Fur Day. But then that's pretty much it for 2000.
Dr. Mario.
Animal Crossing was only in Japan, of course. So, you know.
But I mean, to John's point, that's pretty much it for 2000.
No, 2001 was brutal. I mean, that.
Oh my God.
I mean, that is funny.
And one of the games John lists here didn't even come outside of Japan.
Yeah. So,
Tobutsu no Mori, i.e., Animal Crossing.
No, yep. I mean, that's the thing, though. I mean, I had a Game Boy or a Game Boy Color, but a lot of the stuff about GBA really appealed to me because, you know, the whole portable Super Nintendo thing, and that was my favorite hardware generation growing up. You know, that was like, I started with NES, but Super NES was the one that was really kind of special to me. So I was leaning towards GBA anyway, but the absolute famine of games in 2001, you know, just kind of made it essential, really, because the N64 wasn't providing much of anything past Conker that I can recall, but certainly 2000 was excellent, stellar. And, you know, I mean, you get some of the usual suspects back again. Kirby, Rare Games, you know, Zelda was becoming a bit of a, this had become kind of a staple, late Zelda games.
Right.
It hadn't always been the case, you know, when you think of Zelda 2, Link to the Past, but, you know, as now it's kind of a regular thing. They don't really get around to doing an original Zelda game till the end.
Beyond the players being similar, even if you look at what the games that are coming out, like Mickey Speedway, USA, a kart racer. Oh, a kart racer on the N64. Like, there were four really stellar kart racers on that system. There's a lot of multiplayer here, because the N64, unlike its peer, the PlayStation, could do four-player gameplay naturally.
Perfect Dark was just Perfect Dark. Sensational for the time in its multiplayer.
You know, there's a lot of multiplayer. There's a lot of, you know, Pokemon. We got a double dose Pokemon on the N64.
It was the time.
So it's, you know, the N64 really. 2000 is kind of a microcosm of what that system was, essentially. I mean, it really is sort of that system distilled into one year.
No, that was, I think, a really, really nice year. You can only wonder, had the system been more successful to that point, you had more third-party games to supplement it, it could have been, you know, really, really good and stood with some of the other systems. But the top end is still excellent.
Oh, unbelievable.
Really, really good. But going on to GBA, which
is... Didn't want to break the Game Boy Color out on its own?
On the subject of late-era Zelda games, Oracle of Ages and Seasons, which came out at about the same time as the GBA, didn't it?
It did. It launched either day and date or right after, because it had special content.
Yeah, I got actually a Game Boy Color. I won it by with a slushy. Anyway,
nice.
And it was very late, and so I got tons of games like the Dragon Warrior 1 and 2. The two Zelda games, Pokemon Pinball, Wario Land 3, And also Mario Tennis and Mario Golf, which were kind of mini RPGs. You know, like they're on the Virtual Console now,
yeah.
So people can check them out.
And of course, they linked into the N64 games as well, didn't they?
Yep.
Like, you know, which was something that Pokemon kind of made that possible, because that was, you know, the transfer pack. You know, a lot of people were going to have it because of Pokemon.
In a way, pretty much all Pokemon Color games were. I'm sorry, geez, all Game Boy Color games were kind of lit Game Boy Color games, because it didn't really, because the Game Boy Advance came out pretty hot on its heels. But
yeah.
To me, yeah, the last Game Boy Color game I bought, and one of my favorites, was Mega Man Extreme 2, which is
that
weird where they started doing Super Nintendo stuff down to handhelds, because the Super Nintendo had started to get that point people were remembering it fondly.
Oh.
And then that goes full throttle on the Game Boy Advance.
Yeah, big time. Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, that was probably, I mean, and the Extreme 2 is on the Virtual Console, isn't it? On the, you know, so you could go back and check those out. But I mean, it's kind of that vintage, like the Goemon game I mentioned as well. Like, you know, where you were getting, yeah, that was very much like a Super Nintendo shrunk down to a Game Boy Color game, something that the third parties in Japan were doing. And I guess, you know, the GBA was the kind of natural evolution of that, is give us a format that was just a lot more apt to
capable.
Do it. But what that kind of leads on to is the fact that once the GBA has a weird life cycle, because it was kind of cut off in its prime relative to some of these others because of the sort of hurried nature of the DS, you know, the development of that, the launch of that, the concern about the PSP.
So we're actually getting into the time of RFN at this point.
Yeah, we are. We late era GBA is getting into 2006, so you know, that's
we were on the show talking about the GBA that won't die.
how many of them are micros? We all remember the good old days. But you know, I think the notable thing about the late era GBA is that it had got away from just, okay, let's do Super Nintendo type of games. You know, again, similar to what I talked about, you know, with some of these, with the original Game Boy stuff, you know, it had more of its own kind of confidence to do its own things by the, like, one of my favorite late GBA games is WarioWare Twisted, which of course is a WarioWare game. It comes from the first WarioWare game, which was such a portable game, even though they did the GameCube version, they've done the Wii version and whatnot. But to me, it's born out.
Twisted is unbelievable.
Twisted's probably the best WarioWare. I mean, most people kind of feel like, well, I've not played all of them. I've played, you know, quite a few at this point, and it's my favorite. It's a terrific game. I don't know whether it ever came out in some European countries because of the, there was like some kind of heavy metal in the motion sensor that was against EU regulations or something.
Nice.
So absolutely, but so it's not even a late game.
Thanks, Europe.
It's off the scale, but
thanks, safety.
It is a terrific, terrific game, and it's just so far away from just aping 16-bit games at that point. You know, it's really, you're moving it around, you know, you can't really play it on the Game Boy Player. You know, it is a portable game, and it is fantastic.
Yeah.
And what they had plenty of good games that didn't come out here or in America because of the nature of, you know, how they kind of wanted to cut off, you know, support and kind of push people towards DS. So the first Rhythm Tengoku, an amazing game. Yep. I absolutely love that.
Mother 3,
of course.
You said good games, John.
The famous example, but there was plenty of good ones that did come over as well, like Drill Dozer.
Drill Dozer is unbelievably amazing.
And of course, a sort of rare case where the Game Freak got to cast off their Pokemon chains. Minish Cap, which actually in America came out after the DS, didn't it?
Yes, because I played on the DS.
GBA's life cycle is quite unlike most others in that, you know, it really just, I think, you know, Nintendo software planning didn't anticipate that they were going to be killing it off in the way they did. You know, so there was quite a lot of overhang there.
This weird period where you had some developers coming up with like two versions of their games, so that you had Scourge the Hive that came out on both DS and GBA, and then
they quite did that with Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, the original red blue one. The red one was Game Boy Advance, the blue one was a DS game.
Yeah. So With GameCube, then we move on to what is, for me, I don't know whether it was, probably one of the weakest end of
Sonic. It's sad.
It really dried up quickly.
Not that there isn't, you know, some great stuff, but Nintendo's approach was a little bit different on GameCube. It seemed like they tried hard to have stuff coming out fast. You know, they talked about having games that were maybe a bit smaller, you know, that didn't require as much work so that, you know, there wouldn't be some of the prolonged gaps, that you saw on N64. But what that kind of meant was it was a bit front loaded by comparison. And so once you get to 2005, there's not a whole lot. I mean, if you count Resident Evil 4, which was January of 2005.
2005 right. Has more than you think, though.
Resident Evil 4 is you know, really a humongous game. It's sort of,
John, why does your list have Shadow the Hedgehog in it?
That was for you, James. But yeah,
you
so my list,
son of a bitch.
My list for 2005 is Resident Evil 4, Star Fox Assault, Donkey Kong, Jungle Beat, Killer 7, The Incredible Hulk Ultimate Destruction, which was really good.
Amazing game.
Mario Superstar Baseball, Battalion Wars, Fire Emblem, Path of Radiance, Beautiful Joe Red Hot Rumble, which was meh, but Shadow the Hedgehog's fucking amazing. And Super Mario Strikers. So there was a lot.
But keep in mind, that's basically all the system had. Like, the third parties had really dried up a bit on the GameCube.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, you had some games. Like, I remember being actually into some EA games. Like, you still had SSX4 on tour. You still had the NBA Jam, NBA
EA Sports was still hanging
Volume 3.
They had the Mario crossovers with those, didn't they? You know, to kind of give it a reason to buy it on GameCube.
Yeah, but some notable franchises just went missing, like Burnout 3 did not come out on GameCube.
Right. Soul Calibur 3 didn't come out.
It was popular. Right.
No Kirby this time as well. No Kirby. To swoop in and help. With
the Kirby. Well, I mean, because we had that fantastic Kirby Air Ride. That's pretty much it.
But yeah, there was. We know now that they had a Kirby game. They teased it a bunch of times. But it never happened. And kind of, I guess, returned to Dreamland, a late Wii game.
Yes, it's kind of that game.
It's kind of that game. Yeah. I mean, Jungle Beat's fantastic. Really like that. The beginning of EAD Tokyo. That's wonderful. Chibi Robo is another really fun.
Yeah, that's 2006.
2006
game.
Yeah, which I didn't play until it was on Wii with the new play control stuff. But really good stuff. So there's good games there, but
there's
Odama.
Origins, button. Yeah, Odama. Goichi Suda's mind F of a game. Is that
Goichi Suda, really?
No, is that Yute Saito?
Yute Saito, I'm sorry. Those psychopaths are all mixed up. Yeah, Yute Saito. But to me, Baten Kaito's Origins, the best JRPG on the platform, which is hard to say sometimes because there's not that many, but really, really good game that actually I think I may have talked about on the show contemporaneously.
Right.
And then, of course, Twilight Princess, which we just did a retroactive on.
Yep.
2006, like, I just remember I played Chibi-Robo, and then I started buying PlayStation 2 games, even though I did not own a PlayStation. And,
like, that was the time. Good lord.
Yeah, but I was like, okay, so this Katamari Damashi game looks interesting, and then I saw Ico and I was like, oh, I heard that's rare, so I picked that up, and I was collecting these games, and eventually I found a good deal on PlayStation 2, and the GameCube was just not enough at that point. Like, there was a release every maybe 3 months.
The GameCube was so not enough, you were buying games for a platform you didn't have.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I was, you know, I was in college, I was managing my money, I was waiting for a good deal.
Fair enough. Gil makes the ant in the ant and the grasshopper look like a procrastinator.
Just, you know, the GameCube, it just didn't have the same kind of, it didn't have this, some of this is getting older, but it just didn't have the same feeling of progression in the design and the, I mean, obviously late era GameCube games look way better than the early stuff. I'm not denying that. There's some, I mean, Resident Evil 4 is certainly, you know, way more spectacular than the early stuff, for instance. But I don't know, it just didn't feel as significant as a kind of progress in terms of game design and spectacle as you've got in previous generations.
Forms had become much more developed in the 3D space at that point, because you're dealing with year 15 of 3D games being the primary development. So
No, yeah. they've adapted to it at this point, and obviously Nintendo were, you know, going to be working on a system that was very much like the GameCube. So a lot of games that would have been late GameCube games, didn't it? Like Super Paper Mario, for instance, Twilight Princess, you got both, but, you know, a lot of people probably played it on Wii. And that's another sort of thread, isn't it? Mario RPGs always seem to show up late for some reason, but going back to your Paper Mario.
Oh, Super Paper Mario's here, shut the party down.
So, yeah, for some reason, that maybe Paper Jam will be the close out the lights game for the 3DS, I don't know. But, you know, it did feel like a bit of a death march, with the GameCube, even though there was some good stuff, and it didn't have quite the same kind of flourishes. Like most of the stuff I remember from the GameCube the most fondly comes earlier, but I guess it was offset by the fact that this was like pretty much the peak of the DS explosion.
Yes.
You know, from the middle of 2005 onwards, DS was just, it was raining games.
When that corner turned, people understood how to make DS games.
Yeah, so that kind of mitigated the overall pain of being a Nintendo gamer. But if for some reason you were only on GameCube, I will have to think that would have been the roughest.
Oh, it would have been terrible. It would have been unbearable. And I think ultimately, the end of the GameCube is why I became a day one buyer of consoles for the first time in my life. Well, that's not true. I day one bought the GameCube, but there was a whole different reason there. Okay. But I day one bought a DS, which was just released in the middle of, you know, spring.
And that was a bad purchase right at the start.
It was, but things were so dire at that point, it didn't matter. Because, like, you could see Nintendo was trying to turn the lights off on the Game Boy Advance. Like, we need to get out of here.
Well, with Ping Pals, I mean, they almost did it, you know?
The obligatory Ping Pals.
Ping Pals almost turned the lights off everywhere.
One of my favorites.
All right. We're not going to Pink Pals because we've actually run a little long here. Who would have
thought that covering at the end of every cycle ever might have taken a while?
Yeah, so I think we're going to call it at the GameCube. We'll find some time to reflect on late DS games and.
To be fair, for DS, we've got episode 200.
Yeah.
And for Wii, we've got episode 300. So.
You know what? You're right. Go listen to those episodes.
They cover all the stages of the life cycle, but, you know, they certainly cover the end as well.
Right.
But, you know, you see some of these trends kind of playing out with those, but...
Chibi Robo shuts it down on the DS.
if
you shop at Walmart...
No, I was like in the middle. The unlocalized one was quite late.
Oh, that's true. You're right.
The big writ sweep or whatever.
Yeah.
Rhythm Tengoku comes in at the end of Wii, which is
shut it all down.
More RPGs, more Kirby. It's all about RPGs, Kirby, Rhythm Tengoku.
God.
they are the guys that close out the lights.
So, it's time for the retroactive poll again. But we don't know what games you want to put on there. We've got some ideas, but we have a theme. And we want you guys to suggest to us games we might not think of for this theme. And the theme is, in light of the upcoming release of Mario Maker, Mario games that are not covered by Mario Maker. So what does that mean? That means no Super Mario Brothers, no Super Mario Brothers 3, no Super Mario World, no New Super Mario Brothers, New Super Mario Brothers 2, 3, 4, Luigi. It's all about the gold, you, anything. All that's out. Gone. What's left? Well... does it have Mario in it in some way, shape, or form? Guess what? It's good. Can you get it on a virtual console, or is it available for a system that you can play right now? As in, could I play this on a Wii, a Wii U, or a 3DS? The answer is yes, and it's not prohibitively expensive, then it's eligible. What does that mean? That means you've got a lot of games to pick from because Nintendo ain't real creative in their character designs and put Mario friggin' everywhere. He's not a doctor, but he's in a lot of games where he's claiming to be one. So... you can send us your suggestions about what I'm going to air quote that Mario games are available that you want us to do as a retroactive. You could send us your list of games to our email, rfnintendoworldreport.com, or you could talk to our newly minted social media manager, Mr. John Lindemann himself, at RFN Podcast.
I don't recommend it.
I don't recommend it either. In fact, this might be the only podcast that's being its host is actively being trolled by its social media account. So, with that, you can send your suggestions there.
I'm just managing the social media, James. That's all I'm doing.
You certainly are. We will be announcing the poll in conjunction with the actual release of Mario Maker, and then we'll also be talking about what we're going to do with that game, how we're going to cover that game personally, because it may not be something that's the most conducive to just talking about. Hey, John, I made a level, and I put three red paratroopers in there. It's there's a conversational problem that happens there, so we'll have to work through it. But
thrilling, James.
It's thrilling, I know. So, send us your suggestions. Again, you can also send us your email. Questions, comments, music suggestions at rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And of course, you can always use the form that is in every show notes where we describe the episode as well. And we have all kinds of links and stuff that you may care about. Like, I don't know, stuff. Related content. I've lost the thread because I got distracted by John harassing me on Twitter. I'm just thinking about it now. Sorry.
Oh, God.
We're going to need to cut there somewhere. I apologize, Guillaume. But
I kind of zoned out a bit.
That's good, because so did I, and I'm hosting this, so that's fine. That's fine. So, speaking of music suggestions, like I said, you can send them to the email. And this week, actually, we're doing my music suggestion. And this is the theme music to Ixataka, the forest civilization from Skies of Arcadia on the GameCube. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Later.
That was flaccid.